This is The Sweeper, the global football podcast with the best worldwide news and stories from the beautiful game, with Lee Wingate and Paul Watson.
On this episode of The Sweeper, we speak to the new coaches of Micronesia and Nauru, talk about the frenetic title race on the Scilly Isles, and laugh at the AIK fans who smuggled a kayak into a recent Swedish Cup tie. Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Sweeper podcast, where Paul Watson and myself, Lee Wingate, bring you the news and stories from around the football world you won't hear anywhere else. On this pod, we'll be covering all the talking points across Europe, from Sweden to the Scilly Isles. But first up today, we're heading over to Oceania to hear from the head coaches of some international minnows and to tell you the amazing story of two French journalists with big dreams in American Samoa. Shall we kick off the pod there, Paul?
I think we should. That sounds like a good place to start.
Yeah, alphabetical order. So what's been happening in American Samoa?
So we've spoken a bit about American Samoa and how it probably legitimately could be seen as the weakest nation in FIFA at the moment, despite, you know, the complexities of the world rankings. And I think American Samoa has been in people's minds most lately because of Next Goal Wins, which was a brilliant documentary about American Samoa finally winning a game, which is now way back, but finally winning a game after, I think it was 38 consecutive failures to win a game. And this was a very sort of positive story, very, very feel-good story. But the reality is that football in American Samoa is not in a great place, I think we can agree. And we spoke about recently Viala Tongan, who were in the OFC Champions League, and their demolition that they took at the hands of the other teams in the qualifiers. So this leads on to this lovely story, which I think, again, is quite feel-good, of two French journalists, Vladimir Krashenko and Guillaume Lejeune, who decided that they wanted to play in the OFC Champions League. They're sort of wannabe journalist stroke footballers, a bit like myself back in the day. And they decided, let's see if we can play in a Champions League competition. Well, OFC is probably the best bet for that. And tracked down Pago Pago Youth, who are in American Samoa, and said, can we come and play for you? Which is very much something that sounds like something I would do, to be honest.
Yeah, and as far as I understand it, they were basically accepted, no questions asked.
Yes. Yeah, the amazing thing is they very much were. It was sort of received with enthusiasm. I don't even think there were an awful lot of questions about their playing credentials. But the date that this happened, I think for anyone who's listening, will kind of tip you off about what went wrong here. So it was 2020 that they made this approach, early on in 2020. And it all looked very good. They were going to go out to American Samoa, begin this adventure. And of course, COVID struck. And of all the places in the world, actually, the Pacific probably had the tightest rules around COVID. There were lockdowns that stayed for a really, really long time in that part of the world. Because small island communities, it was very hard to keep people safe, and to vaccinate was more difficult in these communities. So American Samoa shut down, and this dream was sort of put on ice. Then things opened up again, but the complication became that the club they'd committed to, Pago Youth, didn't qualify for the OFC Champions League, but they'd already sort of decided to work with them. So it would have been kind of a bit of a faux pas to jump ship. Another thing had happened, which is that Crescenzo had got injured. So the journalist, one of the journalists, I think kind of the driving force, had got himself injured. He was also maybe just getting a little bit past his footballing prime, which is something I identify with, and felt that perhaps now he wasn't going to be able to go over there and dazzle in the OFC Champions League in the way that he intended. But a man after my own heart, he's refusing to allow this dream to die, as he's instead sort of pivoted it to a new idea, which is to bring three or four probably French players over to American Samoa to do the job for him. So effectively, he's turned sort of, I guess, recruiter or coach almost, and still has decided that they are going to bring Champions League glory to American Samoa, a first Champions League win. And that's where we are right now, is looking at whether they're going to be able to do that, I suppose, in time for next year's OFC Champions League.
That's so unfortunate in terms of the timing, though, isn't it? Because at the time that he sort of began this venture, as far as I can see, Pago Pago had won the league 4 years in a row up until that point. And then obviously a massive worldwide event happens and it just completely derails the dream. So he couldn't have really got much more unlucky, could he?
No, it was absolutely ridiculously unfortunate timing. And when you think about the number of obstacles that stood in the way of this project, I mean, it's an absolutely crazy project. For that to be the one that comes and unseats them, you know, something nobody could have seen coming, feels very unlucky, really. And I think had that not happened, he probably would have realised this dream by now and actually got on the field. It would have been fascinating to see what would have happened.
Some of the clubs in American Samoa have quite interesting stories or little facts associated with them. So when we came to prepare for this episode, I had a little rundown of the league table. Pago Pago are the most successful team with 8 titles. You've also got the second most successful team, Panzer East, 4-time champions. But their first title in the year 2000 was shared with a club called Wild Wild West, which I absolutely love. But how do you share a title? Do they not separate based on goal difference or head-to-head or one of these things? I really don't know.
That's bizarre. I don't know if I've ever heard of that happen before. As you say, there are many ways you could probably settle that, especially on quite a small island. It wouldn't have been that hard to sort of bring them together to play a decider, you'd have thought. You've done really well to even find this information. I can't stress enough that even as absolute obscure football nerd like me, it is very hard to find good information about football in American Samoa.
Yeah, I mean, one of these teams, Wild Wild West, was a Wikipedia red link. So the amount of information is obviously limited. Another team, Utalay Youth, 2-time champions. They were one of the last clubs in world football to complete a perfect season back in 2014. So they won every single game in the league that year. And then there's Ilaoa Toamata, who have a transgender player, Jaya Sayalua, who we've talked about on the pod before, one of the protagonists of this Next Goal Wins film and accompanying documentary. And I think she became the first transgender player to ever take part in a FIFA World Cup qualifier. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct. And yeah, just like a really inspirational story. Probably the, in a way, the story that made Next Goal Wins as a documentary. I think, you know, we all liked the kind of the Minnow story and the fact that American Samoa do record this victory over Tonga is lovely and, you know, really interesting in to people like us. But what really, I think, transcended was this incredible story of Jaya. And I guess the way it revealed things about Polynesian society, the fact that there is a third gender that's very widely recognised, and Jaya playing on the field with all the men, there wasn't an issue. It wasn't a problem. There was no stigma societally on that. And I found that really interesting personally.
I still haven't actually seen either the documentary or the film, but I think now they're quite high on my list, having done the research for this pod. Jaya is still playing at 35 years old. She's still playing for her village club, which is, as I say, Ilaoa Toamata. They were the American Samoan representatives in the 2023 OFC Champions League preliminary round. And I saw that they didn't actually complete all 3 of their games because they lost the first 2 by a combined scoreline of 21-0. And then their third match was cancelled due to the threat of a cyclone, which is just something that, you know, in the part of the world where we come from, you just don't hear about that. But I guess these extreme weather events must have quite an impact on football in Oceania.
Wow, yeah. And we've seen this a little bit, didn't we? We saw this in the Pacific Games when the Tuvalu team simply didn't arrive for their first game. And being Oceania, there was very little communication initially about what had happened. I tuned in waiting for the game and continued waiting for about an hour and a half on this stream and thinking, what's happened? And again, that was weather related. They'd got stranded because a flight had been cancelled by bad weather and the team was stuck. I think they were stuck en route to Samoa. They'd got stuck somewhere like New Zealand. And these are the kind of things that do happen in that part of the world. And when you combine that with how incredibly expensive flights are, and how limited opportunities are to compete, certainly, especially internationally, makes it a real potent combination. And I think possibly one of the reasons, again, you know, why American Samoa just has the odds against them in a way that a similar sort of lowly nation in any other confederation perhaps wouldn't have so much to overcome.
Well, we're going to talk about some other lowly nations in the Pacific next. But before we do, we've got an exciting giveaway to tell you about. We've teamed up with our friends at Stings ProWear, the designers of the three beautiful Micronesian national team shirts that we spoke about recently, to give away one of the Pago Pago youth shirts. It's an amazing jersey. Paul, can you paint sort of a word picture of this shirt to us?
It's yellow.
No, I can do better than that.
It is, though. It is yellow, and it has sort of tribal patterns down the sides, almost sort of coming around the rib cage area, like coming up to your ribs from the bottom. It has a white trim with a little bit of black stripes on the sleeve. It is really beautiful. I can't do it justice. But also, if you are somebody who walks around in football shirts in normal life, if you play five-a-side, whatever you do, if you're ever out wearing this shirt, it will be definitely one of the coolest shirts to sort of just drop the name, just say, oh, it's Pago Youth. They're big in American Samoa. It just sounds very cool.
To give the listeners a little bit of insight into how we record these pods, they go out, of course, late on a Tuesday, early on a Wednesday, depending on where you are in the world. But we record them on a Monday. And that initial description of it's yellow was very much Monday vibes from Paul.
Yeah, I didn't sell it, did I? But I'm also not the best at describing sort of colours and patterns and things like that. But it's a lovely shirt, honestly. I'd be very happy to win one myself.
Yeah, the caption underneath says "World Without Strangers." It's just very, very cool overall. For a chance to win it, simply sign up to our Patreon at patreon.com/sweeperpod by Wednesday, the 20th of March, and then we will draw a winner at random. Also, I did some very pointless calculations the other day to illustrate what you would get if you signed up to our Patreon for £5 a month over a year. If you did that, you would get around 20 hours of bonus pod content. You would get 156 world football stories in our newsletters. You'd get bonus blogs. You get to join 150 other patrons on our Discord forum. And you get to take part in obscure giveaways like that. So if you want some more Sweeper, then do sign up and support the pod at our Patreon page, patreon.com/sweeperpod. All right, on to our next Pacific-related topic, and that is Micronesia and Nauru. Micronesia have a new coach, don't they, Paul?
They do. So Micronesia has a new coach. It's an American, David Johnson, who's become the coach, and he's just arrived in Pompeii, where he's going to be for the next 2 months.
Yeah, and we actually have a voice note from David as well. As you say, he's arrived just recently in Micronesia. So let's go over to him now and find out how he got the role and what his first impressions have been.
Hi all, from the beautiful Cliff Rainbow Hotel here in Ponape FSM. My name is David, and I'm the newly appointed head coach of the FSM FA. I'd like to thank Paul and Lee for having me on the Sweeper. It was actually this podcast that I heard about the FSM FA and the amazing things people are doing for football in the region. And I reached out to Paul on Twitter and pretty much said, hey, love what you guys are doing. If you need any help, let me know. Long story short, that turned into me being the head coach here. I arrived in Ponape about a week ago. My first impression is that it's absolutely breathtaking. I left Ohio with 3 inches of snow on the ground, and I arrived in FSM to 85 degrees, 75% humidity, and a nice breeze flowing through. It's absolutely perfect conditions here. Not a bad place to spend the next 2-3 months. My first impression of the team, honestly, I didn't know exactly what to expect from talking to Paul and other coaches that have come before me. When I arrived at the first practice, I was very happily shocked and taken away. The amount of players here, that are so well-rounded. You ask pretty much any player on the team what position they play, and they'll be able to rattle off 7, 8, 9 different positions that they feel completely comfortable playing. I've never had a team with so many well-rounded players, especially by this point in this age. Players are shoehorned into 1 or 2 positions, and that's pretty much all they can do. I believe it's been announced already on social medias, but with the futsal tournament that we'll be having against the other Micronesian countries this summer, that will be absolutely massive, right? Futsal is a sport that you want to have that fluidity of play, the ability to play both sides of the ball, all positions, both sides of the field, is absolutely massive. It makes me very hopeful and optimistic that the FSM will be able to lift an international trophy sooner than later.
Well, how about that, Paul? David Johnson saying there that he got his international management gig partly because of our podcast.
Exactly right. So another reason to listen to the Sweeper. You may well end up coaching Belgium or no, okay, but you may well end up finding strange opportunities that pop up out of nowhere. It's lovely to hear.
I was just thinking, he said there, how can I help in any way? And he's probably thinking, I don't know, maybe do a bit of research or something. And instead you've sent him to Micronesia.
Hey, I've not sent anyone anywhere. I simply facilitated the introductions, and it's really nice because you get this kind of relationship when people talk about really small footballing nations, that they kind of talk about them as if they expect them to have a marketing department, a, you know, whatever department. And instead, you just end up introducing them to the three people who go, yeah, if you want to come out, you can be our coach. You know, it's a different world, right?
With you linking up now national teams and coaches, can we call you the Fabrizio Romano of Oceania?
Yeah, I think we definitely can. Start doing my here we go and just like a picture of a sort of a small town in American Samoa. People scratching their heads. What? Who goes where?
One question I had after listening to that voice note from David is, why is it such a short-term appointment? Obviously, 2 to 3 months. How much can he realistically achieve in that time frame?
That's a good question. No, he's only on the island in this trip for 2 to 3 months. So the position is his ongoing. But obviously, the nature of the thing is that he's a volunteer. He's had to pay his own way to even get to Micronesia because there just is no money for this kind of stuff. So it's really a case of him spending that time out there. The impact he can have is actually pretty phenomenal. We had a coach out there, a British coach called Chris Smith, brilliant coach, who very similarly approached me some years back and said, you know, I'm interested in coaching in Micronesia. I explained all the reasons it could be difficult, explained the financial problems, and he again just saw it through, just fundraised his own way, went over there. And when I went back last year, the players were still talking in these absolutely glowing terms about the impact he had had on them. And that was a trip of 3 months, and that was 4 years ago. So the impact you can have on a young player, especially somewhere where access to coaching is so incredibly limited and where players don't feel like anyone really takes a lot of notice out in the outside world, you can make a massive, massive difference to these kids, especially these younger players, in quite a short space of time. So I'm really excited by what David can achieve, to be honest.
Yeah, we wish him the very best of luck, and I'm sure we'll be touching back on how that coaching appointment is going. But onto another one now, that is Nauru. There's a new coach in Nauru as well, and how much of a hand have you had in this one?
I've got to say, I'm slightly responsible for this one too. I introduced the coach, I suppose, in a way, although this is a slightly strange one. So Nauru, I was there in 2018, and there really was no football, but there was an interest in getting things going. And then I met a Brit who runs a tour company called Young Pioneer Tours. And he, by complete chance, is obsessed with Nauru, goes there annually, if not more, which makes him probably the person who's visited Nauru the most in the world, because he runs a tour there every year. I think it's a New Year's tour, and it's very cool. It's like a pub crawl across the smallest island nation in the world. This is very cool. And this guy, Gareth, British guy, said, look, we've got to have a football team in Nauru. So I actually, more than that, facilitated the introduction of him to Kaz Kane, who is the president of Nauru Football, who is the person who primarily, when I was there, said, we need to get football going. And those two then brought Charlie in, who's now going to be the head coach. And he is a real character. We've spoken about him before on this pod because he runs a football club in Cambodia, which has been fighting basically against absolutely all the odds. We last met him, we sort of introduced him when he had just had a game where he had tried to cancel the match because more or less all his team were ill with a virus and the request had been refused. So he had no goalkeeper and sort of this bare bones team. And he had had to be the kit man himself. And he was sitting sort of in the changing room with wet, still damp kits, just thinking, this is going to go badly. And sure enough, they lost 14-0. So if anyone can take on a challenge, I'd say it's probably Charlie.
Well, let's hear from Charlie now, because we also have a voice note from him. This is Nauru's new head coach, Charlie Pomroy.
Hi, I'm Charlie Pomroy, the head coach of the Nauru national team. For those that don't know, Nauru is a tiny island just north of Australia, and has never ever played a competitive football match, and nor will you even find football on the island. I got to be involved in the project through Gareth Johnson, who is the head of the Football Federation in Nauru, and him and Paul, who I've known for a little while now, brought me in originally as a board member. And then late last year was given the chance, well, was offered the job as head coach, and it was too good of a opportunity to turn down. What's most exciting to me about the Nauru project is it's not just building a football team or building a development system or a pathway from the ground up. What we're trying to do here is ingrain this sport that we all love into their culture. That's going to be a very interesting task, and It's the one aspect that I feel probably the strongest trait that I have as a coach is getting people to fall in love with this game. And I think that's what I'm going to bring to this project in particular. But for me, that's the most exciting part. And obviously we want to be successful. I wouldn't expect us to be qualifying for any World Cup in the near future. But the goal for 2024 is certainly to play our first international game, as well as spend a significant amount of time on the island inputting and implementing our system.
What do you think then, Paul? Can Charlie enthuse the people of Nauru for football?
It's going to be a challenge. The big sport there really in many ways is Aussie rules football. So there's an amazing thing they do where Aussie rules clubs in Australia, I believe, sponsor players in Nauru to have a sort of version of their teams playing against each other. So you'd have like players dressed in the uniforms of these Aussie rules teams playing in Nauru. And they're really talented, like some of these kids. So I think the biggest thing that he might have to do is try and encourage people who already play a different sport to come and also try a bit of football on the side. I think that's probably the cleverest route through, because there are definitely talented athletes in Nauru. There's no doubt about that. What I find really fascinating actually is that Nauru specifically has this very big pull around the world with kind of obscure football lovers, to the extent where there's a group of South Americans who set up a website a while back for a Nauru football league, and they populated it with team names and player names and match results. And I found out about this because I got a call at some crazy time in the morning from someone in Micronesia who was saying, is this real? You know, has Nauru got a football league now? And sure enough, over the course of the day, more and more people were approaching me, especially South American people were messaging me on Facebook saying, have you heard about this Nauru football league? And I could not work out what was going on, because I looked at this website and it just didn't tally with what I'd seen relatively recently in Nauru, which was that the sport was completely in its infancy. But this website was showing squad numbers and, you know, referee name, and it looked so together. It looked like Serie A matches or Premier League matches. And so sure enough, scratched the surface a little bit and found out that these games were all complete fabrications. The players didn't exist. I messaged the guys I knew in Nauru. They're like, no, none of these players, none of these people exist. Except for, by chance, they'd sort of almost AI'd a load of surnames and first names from Nauru. So occasionally they would come up with a real person, but it would be something like a 75-year-old man in the Senate or something who was playing left wing for Anibare FC. And so it was all completely fake. And when we tracked down the people who'd done it, it wasn't actually that hard to find them. They had a sort of contact address on there. They were not actually apologetic at all. They said, we were doing this to inspire the people of Nauru to play football. But actually, the reality was, everyone who I spoke to on the island, there wasn't that many people, but I spoke to some people on the island, they were just bemused and ever so slightly offended by it, I think. It was a really weird moment.
Yeah, what an odd thing to do. Well, whatever Charlie does then, probably setting up fake websites is not one of his best potential strategies to bring the people of Nauru closer to football. But we will leave our Oceania segment there. We wish both David and Charlie the best of luck. And I'm sure on a future pod, we will be touching back on Micronesia and Nauru. But for now, let's take a quick break and then we'll be back in just a second to tell you some stories from the Scilly Isles and Sweden. Welcome back to part two of this Sweeper podcast, and it's time for us to make a return to Europe. Paul, we've talked on this show before about the Scilly Isles, an archipelago off the coast of the UK with only two teams, the Woolpack Wanderers and the Garrison Gunners. But now we have a new story from the world's smallest football league, don't we? What was it that you tweeted about last week?
Well, it came to my attention that the league title was going to go to the last day, which is probably a relief for everybody. I saw that the Garrison Gunners have beaten the Woolpack Wanderers 9-3 to take the advantage to the last day, but they're both equal on points, so they have the goal difference advantage. So that was setting up for a pretty appetizing final day shootout.
Yeah, which is mad when you think about it. If you have only two teams that play each other between 14 and 20 times a season, in addition to cup competitions, you would think that one of them would pull away from the other quite significantly. But for them to be separated on goal difference going into the final day is mad. And we were hoping to be able to tell you about what happened on the final day in today's podcast. But around an hour ago, I got a DM from the good people at World's Smallest Football League on Twitter who told me that the pitch is waterlogged, sent me a 1 minute video of them walking around the waterlogged pitch. And so the game didn't actually take place. So we're still none the wiser about who's going to win.
Oh, that's a shame. I did worry about the weather a little bit. They posted a picture a little while back, actually, but in January of the pitch, and it looked a little bit on its last legs. I also noticed, I always love this, they always put the attendance of the games, and I wonder if the weather has slightly been responsible for the fact that the attendance for the last game was 12.
I was at the pub yesterday with producer Tom, and he was telling me that the Scilly Isles apparently has a tropical climate, basically has its own microclimate, because it's really westerly location means that it's in the path of the Gulf Stream. And that means that the warm winds create this sort of tropical climate. But I tell you, when I saw the video of this waterlogged pitch today, it looked very much like the UK and not a tropical climate.
I've never heard that. That's an amazing claim. I mean, if you even look at where it's located, it does not feel, it does not look like a tropical place. But I mean, it looks absolutely beautiful. I have to say, every time I see photos of Scilly Isles, they look really, really lovely. But they do not look tropical.
I think tropical asterisk for UK standards is probably what it should read. But I was doing some research about how we would get there if we ever went there at some point. And you've got three ways to get to the Scilly Isles. So the first one is a ferry, which takes 2 hours, 45 minutes from Land's End, so the very southwest of the UK. You've got the plane, which runs also from Land's End, Newquay and Exeter, depending on the time of year, and takes anywhere between 20 and 60 minutes. And of course, the most appealing option is the helicopter, which you can genuinely get like a passenger charter from Penzance Heliport to the Scilly Isles in 15 minutes. And the prices for all of these options are not particularly cheap, I have to say. The flight from Land's End, £134, but the helicopter is only £10 more. So obviously, if you're going to go to the Scilly Isles, you have to take the helicopter, don't you?
We've got to arrive in style. I mean, we are the sweeper as well. We've got to come in on a helicopter, surely.
And then be like lowered down on a rope.
To the most budget accommodation on the Isles of Scilly.
I was thinking straight into the middle of the football pitch, because I saw that this game that ended 9-3, this penultimate match day of the season, one of the teams only had 10 players. So perhaps if they just drop us off straight in the middle of the football pitch, we can get straight involved with the action.
I'm not sure whether a team would be better off with 10 or better off with us being jettisoned into the pitch on their side.
Yeah, fair. I mean, I used to be all right back in the day, but then I got so many injuries that I probably would be more of a hindrance than a help these days. I did also see, by the way, in that 9-3 game, that the goal scorers included D Hicks Jr. one goal and D Hicks Sr. two goals, which means that D Hicks Jr.'s dad scored more goals than him in that game.
Oh, I bet he didn't hear the end of that. I mean, there must be so many of those kind of things in that league, right? Because it's interesting. I wonder if any of them ever played on different teams, whether you get D Hicks Sr. on one team, D Hicks Jr. on the other one. That, then you'd have some edge in it, wouldn't you?
What they apparently do is, and this sounds very much like the school playground, except the pub element of it. At the start of the season, they meet in a pub and they assign two captains and they pick teams. So players do switch teams. I don't think it's the kind of thing where you've got like a one club man that is like Garrison Gunners till I die. I mean, maybe you do have that, but I think they do swap them about. I remember watching some video interview on YouTube where somebody explained that he'd moved between the teams. So yeah, a fascinating place. And I'd really like us to go there at some point. But I think if we were going to go for any game, it should have probably been this title decider.
Yeah, it's true. But I mean, I've got to say, it really is a testament to the way they do pick the teams that it's come out so even. I don't know if it, maybe other years it's not this way, but imagine how demoralizing it would be if you just lost your first sort of, I don't know, whatever, six games of the season, seven games of the season. That was it. And you just basically knew you had to play the rest of the season, but there was no way of catching them up. So it does seem like this sort of playground approach to picking the teams is actually pretty good, isn't it, really?
It seems to be working. Anyway, that's the Silly Isles. Let's move over to Sweden next, from one S to another. We're going to talk about the group stages of the Swedish Cup, which recently finished. I still find it really intriguing that some domestic cup competitions in Europe do have a group stage. We'll talk a little bit about those later. But I wanted to talk today about a meeting of two top flight clubs, AIK Stockholm and Kalmar, because the AIK supporters somehow managed to smuggle a kayak into the stadium. And if you've seen the video, they were basically passing it around the crowd like an alternative Mexican wave. You just see it like moving slowly across the crowd. It's really funny.
How do you smuggle a kayak into a stadium? How do you smuggle a kayak anywhere? That's phenomenal.
I mean, great question. They must have either someone turned a blind eye or I don't know, an immense distraction. But apparently there was a close-up photo which revealed that the markings showed that it had come from the kayak club next door. So someone probably like nabbed this kayak and then just, yeah, somehow got it into the stadium with them. But it's certainly a bizarre video. I'll put a link for the video into the podcast description so you can see the kayak being passed around the crowd. But obviously this set my mind racing. What other things have been smuggled into football stadiums? And I'm not going to do the obvious ones, like you know, the pig's head that got thrown onto the pitch at the Clásico when Luis Figo switched from Barca to Real Madrid. But I've got a few slightly more obscure ones. Do you remember the chicken at Ewood Park in 2012?
No, I don't. In fact, you saying that has made me feel like I'm going mad. No, I would surely remember that.
This was a fan that smuggled a chicken into the stadium to protest against the club's owners, Venky's, which is an Indian poultry firm. And he let the chicken loose onto the pitch. Does that not ring any bells for you?
No, it doesn't. I remember there being a goal where it hit a beach ball. Wasn't that a Blackburn? So I'm wondering if maybe the chicken could have also scored a goal at Blackburn. But no, I don't remember that at all.
I think the beach ball was Sunderland, wasn't it?
Was it? Nah, maybe it was.
The thing I like most about the Blackburn story is that the fan was so committed to getting the chicken into the ground that he took it to the pub, the local pub, the Rose and Crown, first and did like a run-through rehearsal. So apparently the pub was in absolute riots as he was like explaining how he was going to get the chicken in. And then apparently what he did in the end is just put it down his jumper. But how do you put a chicken down your jumper?
And I'm imagining he must have not got any of those sort of pat downs, you know. I don't think you'd come out well if they did a little pat down on you.
Yeah, the other ones I got in 2001, you might know this, little bit of an interest in Italian football on your side, of course. The Inter fans smuggled a moped into the ground ahead of a game against Atalanta, torched it, and then threw it from the upper tier into the lower tier, where fortunately there were no people standing. Again, I'll put the video for this in the description. It's called The Holy Vespa on YouTube. It's said to have been the motorbike of the opposition capo, and it was captured in a pre-match scuffle, then smuggled into the stadium and then thrown off the upper tier.
I do remember that. And I remember at the time just thinking, what a amazing bit of luck no one got hurt by that, because that is absolutely mad, isn't it? Throwing that would kill anyone it lands on. So yeah, that was very ultra-ish behavior, that stealing someone else's moped, torching it and throwing it. And again, just how that got through the authorities, you know, how that got past, shows the power that the ultras have, doesn't it, really, that nobody could stop them doing that.
Yeah, although four of them did get banned for life, so I suppose that they did pay for it in the end. Finally, a French football fan at Euro 2016 shoved an 18-centimetre long flare up his rectum in order to smuggle it into a Euro 2016 game. He then pulled the device out and set it off in the crowd, burning himself and two others in the process.
That's not his finest moment, is it? Imagine going for a job interview and someone just finding that out about you. I think you're not likely to get it then.
Yeah. I did mention a second ago about cup competitions that have a group phase. There are four UEFA member states where the primary domestic cup competition has a group phase. There's also the Icelandic League Cup, for example, which has a group stage. But can you name any of those four UEFA member states, Paul, where the main cup has a group stage? Well, I've given you one, so you can name one.
Or Sweden.
Yeah.
Ah, no. I mean, I don't know that I can. It's one of those things that I feel like I should be able to. But Switzerland?
No, they're sort of Northern European countries, or at least some of them are summer leagues, some of them are Northern European. So Finland, yeah, I think you're about to say that there.
Yeah, but then you gave me Northern European nations, so I was basically just going to guess Finland, Norway, Denmark.
The other two are Russia and Kazakhstan. They both have a group stage as well. But I think that's interesting. For me, a cup competition is supposed to be straight knockouts, so I'm not a huge fan of that.
No, I'm not either. And Russia, that's bizarre, isn't it, when you think about the distances involved in Russia. And in Kazakhstan, the distances in those two countries are famously large between teams. So I think a group stage would be the last thing you'd want, really.
Mm. I think that just about brings our stories for today's episode to an end. Before we round off the episode, I just want to read out one email from a listener. This came from Philip Roth in Switzerland. You may remember from the last podcast, I mentioned that I would love to see a game between Newell's Old Boys and Young Boys of Switzerland. And Philip said to us, "Hey guys, just had to pause the current episode when you said you were wishing for a match between Newell's Old Boys and Young Boys to tell you this story, which you may or may not find interesting. Spoiler, I found it really interesting. There is a club in Basel, Switzerland called BSC Old Boys. They were founded in 1894 as FC Old Boys when a group of students graduated high school and weren't allowed to play for their school's team anymore. When they played a game in 1898 in Bern against FC Bern, a couple of local lads were so impressed by the team that it inspired them to form their own club. Since those boys actually still were in school at the time, they named their club FC Young Boys and even adopted Old Boys' club colours of yellow and black. The two clubs went on fairly different trajectories over the following decades, with Young Boys becoming 16-time and current Swiss champions, while Old Boys never won any major trophies and are currently playing in the fifth tier of Swiss football. Getting back to listening to the episode now, have a lovely day, Philip." Wow, I did not know that.
No, that's brilliant. What a great story. Oh, I love that. I love that we get these kind of these messages from our listeners, because that is amazing.
Yeah, I feel like I learn a lot. We also got some other really good emails, and we might read them out at another time, but we're running out of time for this episode. But you can listen to more of us on our bonus segment. Paul, what are we going to be talking about on our bonus segment, which is now available to listen to on Patreon?
So our bonus segment today, we're going to have some shockwaves in Cambodian football. And we're going to have some focus on two incredible African derbies at the weekend.
Yes, and I will also be talking about the Dominican footballer who recently disappeared on a CONCACAF Champions Cup trip to the USA. So we've got three different stories from three different continents available now on our Patreon page at patreon.com/sweeperpod, where you can also enter the competition for the Pago Pago share, all of that available on Patreon. And remember to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at SweeperPod, because in a week's time, when the next episode comes out, Paul will be in San Marino for the friendly against St. Kitts and Nevis. So plenty of photo and written content from us there. So do follow us on social media. Some people may be wondering, and some have asked, if San Marino finally win and end their 20-year winless run, if we will do an emergency pod. Probably with Paul being in San Marino and me being in New York at the time, we won't do an emergency pod, but we may do a live stream on social media right after the final whistle. So, yeah, that depends very much on San Marino winning, though, doesn't it, Paul?
It does. We're obviously always neutral. We're journalists. But if I've made another trip to San Marino to see them not beat another continental team, then it's going to start to wonder, aren't we, about my life choices?
Yes, well, we'll see what happens. And we will be talking about that, of course, very soon. And finally, one last thing for today. If you know anybody who you think might like this podcast, if you're in football WhatsApp groups and you know people that like either travel, geography, history, football, all the things that we talk about on this pod, then please do share it with them and spread the word about the Sweeper. We've really had a lot of success with word of mouth recommendations. And that's it for today. We'll be back on Wednesday, the 20th of March, with our next podcast.